Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 105 for Tuesday, June 14th. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, the Supreme Court finally rules in I4I v. Microsoft. Next, Apple and Lotus tangle as Apple moves to intervene as Lotus sues more developers. And Apple again in our third story with the iCloud. They just announced, well, it turns out somebody has a common law trademark in that and they want money from Apple for it. We'll dive right into our first story. This is the much anticipated patent law decision from the Supreme Court. Just to quickly recap the facts, I4I made a patent. They had a patent for an XML method regarding Word documents, and Microsoft basically used very similar technology that read on this patent in their version of Microsoft Word and didn't pay I4I for it. I4I sued Microsoft and said, yo, give us money because that's actually our invention because we have this patented. Just a little aside here, in patent law, you don't actually have to steal the idea from someone. It's not like Microsoft looked at I4I stuff and was like, oh, we'll steal their code and do what they do. You just have to do something that reads on a patent. So Microsoft could have come up with it independently, although the evidence actually appears that Microsoft was aware of I4I's product because they had internal emails that were like, hey, look what these guys are doing. We should implement that. So in any case, so Microsoft lost that case at the Federal Circuit level and appealed. And basically their argument was, well, you see, so the gist of it was I4I had made a product sale or allegedly made a product sale. No one could find the source code that was actually involved in that product sale. And there's a section of the patent law 102B that basically says if you sell something more than a year before you try to get a patent for it, you can't get a patent for it, because the whole point of the patent law is to encourage people to patent their devices and patent their inventions so that eventually that knowledge passes into public domain and there's progress of science and the useful arts. So if you just make money off of something and then patent it, more than a year after, that defeats the point. The whole point of the system is to give you a limited monopoly, and you can't really stretch that monopoly out by making money off of it and then turning around and patenting it. Anyway, Microsoft's rather innovative argument was, hey, because this code was never before the patent office, you shouldn't apply the clear and convincing standard that I4I wanted, that had traditionally been used. Instead, you should use the preponderance of the evidence standard, which is a significantly lower standard. Ben, it's more, I mean, percentage-wise, we don't use percentages in law, but effectively it's like 50%, 51% for preponderance of the evidence?
Yeah, it's usually preponderance is 51, 49, and clear and convincing is generally accepted to be somewhere between 75 and 80%.
Yeah. So, a significantly easier bar to get past. So, the court, in their decision, so a little more history. So the court in their decision ruled for I4I in a rather unprecedented 8-0 decision. Justice Roberts abstained because I believe he is a Microsoft stockholder. So 8-0, which is actually pretty surprising. Microsoft had been arguing that, hey, it hasn't been before the Patent Office, you should apply this lower standard. We talked about this on previous podcasts. There were all sorts of issues with that, but I mean, the point was the section 282 of the Patent Act, which was passed all the way back in 1952, just says a patent shall be presumed valid, and the burden of establishing invalidity shall rest on the party asserting it. So it says nothing about the standard used to evaluate that presumption of validity, because it's that the patent shall be presumed valid that creates a presumption of validity, and then we have to have an evidentiary standard to apply to evaluate whether that presumption survives. So what the court found is basically they looked back to a common law, a decision back in 1934, I want to say, RCA versus Radio Engineering Laboratories, and they said that there, it said, the Supreme Court had said, there is a presumption of patent validity that is not to be overthrown except by clear and cogent evidence, and the court says that is clear and convincing, and then they, the court, the majority, the majority actually of the court, says that the that language then was codified in the 1952 Act. Justice Thomas actually has a concurrence where he says that he doesn't actually think that Congress codified it so much as just let it pass through. And I personally agree with him there in that by not stating anything, Congress didn't actually put the common law into law. They just let it pass through the law. I think that's sort of the broad brushstrokes of this decision. It's somewhat surprising in that most observers probably wouldn't have guessed that it would have been this strongly for eye, an 8-0 decision on a case like this. And the reasoning is actually pretty clear and cogent, to reuse some words. It's really straightforward, and the Supreme Court does a really great job explaining how they arrived at their decision. They made it look a lot easier than most observers thought it was initially.
Yeah, I was chatting with David about this before, and you know, one of the things that makes this case interesting is that in previous cases, the Supreme Court had hinted that they kind of wanted to address this issue as to whether or not the standard should be clear and convincing. So then when the case actually came before them, you would have expected, you know, after them, you know, basically prompting somebody to bring this case, that the Supreme Court rather would you know, at least be a little divided about the issue, or be, you know, more leaning toward, you know, flipping the case. But instead, they, you know, do as unanimous as they could, affirmance of the, you know, the old order. And it's not entirely unusual for a court to kind of tee up an issue and then, you know, when they take a closer look at it, go, oh, okay. I guess we were right the first time.
Yeah, it's almost like a head fake for poor Microsoft. David, any thoughts?
Well, Ben and I, before the show, we also went back and tried to determine if we had made any prior predictions in any previous podcasts about this, but we couldn't find any predictions. The last episode I think we discussed this in most recently was episode 79, and then I seem to recall another episode, probably one of our early ones, a year before that, or sometime around then, where we were probably talking about the appeals court decision that came before, of course, the appeal to the Supreme Court. But I don't know that we gave any opinions as to whether we thought the case would come out one way or another. I certainly felt, even though I might not have expressed myself so, that there was probably a better chance that, you know, the court would decide in favor of eye for eye. The Supreme Court has had a history, and you might even say a very recent history, of not wanting to sort of usurp or completely rewrite the patent laws from how they are on the books and then how they have been also in some of the older decisions that have come out of the Supreme Court and in the Federal Circuit. And you can take Bilski perhaps as evidence of that, and a few other cases as well.
Which kind of backtracks on a long history the Supreme Court has of, you know, smacking the Federal Circuit down and telling them that they're just getting it wrong.
Yeah, it's sort of a hallmark, I guess, of the Roberts Court in that it's sort of become much more restrained in terms of creating whole new swaths of the law out of nothing.
Whole cloth, creating them out of whole cloth.
Thank you for fixing my terrible mixed metaphor. Sorry, I'm a little light on sleep right now. So.
No, that's okay. It's also just something that the Supreme Court likes to say, that they like to accuse the, you know, majority or the dissent in the case of trying to create new law out of whole cloth. It's a kind of quaint anachronism that they like to stick around with.
Yeah, so the consequences of this decision are that Microsoft is going to have to pay the largest patent settlement ever. I think it's over $250 million of judgment. For infringing eye for eye, which for Microsoft isn't that much money, but for anyone else is a lot.
And, of course, not to forget, back at the last, at the appeals court level, I believe what the decision coming out of there, and probably the district court as well, was the injunction that Microsoft originally had to deal with regard to the technology it had implemented in Microsoft Word products, or Microsoft Office products. And you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but the underlying patents here dealt with some editing functions with XML?
Right, yeah, XML editing.
So I believe they had to go back and actually modify the code in Office. I never got any confirmation if that's actually what they had done, but, you know, that was sort of the consequence of the injunction back at the appeals court level once that was upheld.
Right, and that did happen. They've modified to Word to take out that code, so they're no longer infringing. And as far as the largest patent judgment go, there's still that lingering case about Apple's use of CoverFlow, which was, and I'm having trouble remembering the exact procedural posture of that case right now, but there was some ridiculously huge, in the billions of dollars, I think it was a $3 billion jury verdict against Apple in that case. And if I recall, the judge did a JNOV, judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and reversed either whole or in part the jury's verdict on infringement and damages. So there's this possibility of, depending on what happens on appeal, a larger verdict happening. But I'm not 100% sure where that stands procedurally right now.
So it's also probably helpful to put this in context as well. A lot of people were watching this case so carefully because, as everyone probably knows, there have been a ton of news stories in the last couple of years about patent infringement lawsuits, about companies suing other companies, about companies acquiring these patents and creating patent thickets in the industry. And people have pointed to it, and a lot of this sort of preceded the Bilski case. They were saying, this is hurting innovation. It's so difficult to enter into some of these markets, or if you are a market player, you sort of don't know if one of these, if some company you've never heard of is going to come up out of nowhere and then sue you for patent infringement because they have a patent that seems to read on something that you're doing. And people wanted to see, or some people in the industry, I should say, wanted to see a lower standard for invalidating some of these patents as a defense to infringement. And of course, Microsoft lost here, so back to the drawing boards, might as well just pump more money into lobbying Congress to try to get a change in the actual law, rather than relying on the courts then to change the status of the law.
Which, at least in my view of jurisprudence, that's a good thing. That's the way it should be. Although I guess you could have ethical qualms about lobbying Congress, but such is the system in which we live.
Yeah, blame the First Amendment for lobbyists.
You get the good with the bad.
Yeah, specifically the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances, not just the general free speech part.
Any other last thoughts on this story?
I'm all set.
All set here.
Okay, I'm gonna take it away to the next story then. So, sticking with the major players in the tech industry, our next two stories actually are about Apple. The first one is that Apple has filed a motion to intervene in the Lodestar patent case. So we talked about the Lodestar case at least once before, I believe twice. And basically, it's a company who, it's a non-practicing entity who licenses out patents for its technology relating to, in this case, in-app purchases and surveys that are given in apps. So Lodestar has a license with Apple Computer, and Apple apparently understood this license to include a right for Apple to sublicense the technology to its developers, or Apple's license covers the use of third-party developers in using Apple's APIs. Lodestar disagrees with this, sent demand orders to several developers. When the developers didn't pay up and when Apple responded, Lodestar moved on its plans to file suit a little early and filed suit against these developers. Apple came out late last week and filed a motion to intervene in this case. So, I guess to discuss what's going on a little bit more is that in the Eastern District of Texas, Lodestar filed a case against seven independent developers: Combay, Icon Factory, Illusion Labs, Michael J. Carr, aka Shovelmate, QuickOffice, Richard Schinderman, and Wolven Game Studios, all of whom offer some form of in-app purchasing. This was one case filed against all seven defendants. Apple is basically trying their best to step in front of the bullet. What they're doing is they're asking to intervene as a defendant and counterclaim plaintiff in that case. So basically, Apple is saying that, yes, you only sued these seven people, but we want to be in the case too. So what Apple it did is they filed what's called a motion to intervene, and they are supporting this on two grounds. First, they're saying that they should be able to intervene as a matter of right, and this is, by the way, governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes. But there are two types of intervening. You can intervene as a matter of right, and you can do that when you've got some sort of property interest in what's going on, and you can do what's called permissive intervention when you do have a an interest in the case, but it's not as strong as intervention as a matter of right. So basically, if Apple meets a certain test, they can intervene as a matter of right. And their argument there is that because they have a license in this patent, they have a property interest in it and some sort of real tangible interest. To intervene for permissive intervention, it's basically to protect the interests of a non-party rather than to protect some sort of property or real tangible interest. Any thoughts from the panel before we delve into this deeper?
Good for now.
It's also worth mentioning that most of these developers, and you might have said this, but I could have just missed it, but most of these developers are really either small companies, a small group of developers, or individuals. So perhaps people that might not have had the means to pay for a licensing or to license the technology from Lodsys.
Yeah, and Lodsys is asking for something like 0.5% of all sales, which, I mean, it's not a lot, but if they're the first in a long line of people who want a chunk of your sales, then that's a problem. And you're right, most of these are very small groups. I think the largest group is Icon Factory, the kind of public face of which is Craig Hockenberry. You can follow him on Twitter. He types in all caps a lot, but is otherwise very funny.
I think you mean he shouts on the internet.
He does, but it's all part of a character. And he also, as a side note, back when Icon Factory makes a program called Twitterific, and he showed me once how to Twitterific had a filtering thing that they were playing around with, and he showed me how to filter out most of his all caps tweets on Twitterific. So he's a very nice guy and good humored about it, but. Unfortunately, he was obviously not very happy to find out that he was getting sued, and right before the Worldwide Developer Conference, nonetheless.
Which, I mean,
The other thing that's oh, go
might
ahead,
have been a
Dominic.
good thing, because it let people actually talk to Apple in person, so.
Yeah, apparently Apple was going around the Worldwide Developer Conference saying, trying to figure out who's gotten threats from whom, and is doing their best to assuage the fears of developers that Apple's going to do their best to stand up for these guys, which is, I mean, it's great and it totally makes sense because a lot of times these apps are what are selling Apple devices. So it's good to see Apple, who doesn't have to stand up for these people, standing up for them.
And I was just going to say actually that Lodsys does have a website and a blog on the website, and they, up until May 31st, they have a couple of posts related to these disputes and, of course, the wide coverage that was in the media. And the last one looks to be a post about Apple's license claims, because Apple at some point had tried to intervene before filing the motion to intervene, that is, in the case itself, by sending a letter to Lodsys. And kind of unclear what the letter was, I didn't actually look it up, but I think that what the gist of what they had said was they have indisputable or undisputable freedom to for their developers to use the claimed inventions on the basis of the license that Apple has with Lodsys. And Apple, excuse me, and Lodsys has a post up saying, no, that's not true. And then the following day after this, I believe was the day that they filed the lawsuit.
Yeah, they Lodsys claims that Apple does not have the right to use pixie dust to just allow other people to use their patent. And without getting too deep into the patent side of this, Apple does have some decent claims that it's really Apple who's using these patents. Well, I mean, there are a couple of things that it's Apple who's using the patent, not the developers, because of the way the whole system works, and also that Apple's license by the explicit terms of the license allow Apple to grant use rights to the third parties here. I gotta think that Lodsys is going to file an opposition to the motion to intervene. just because, if they don't file the motion, if, they can keep Apple out, this is a, in some ways a much easier fight. But yeah, Apple has some very high-powered law firms that do this kind of stuff for them, which makes litigation incredibly, more expensive.
Yeah, Lodestar would do well to avoid tangling with Apple, which is what they were trying to do by suing the developers in the first place and the going around Apple, which is licensed again. Mean, it's definitely the first sort of story of its sort that I can think of where you have small developers being shielded or being attempted to be shielded by a larger company that works with them. Like, I can't think of another case like this. I guess it's sort of a testament to the newness of the App Store ecosystem, if you will, and all of that stuff.
Perhaps. I mean, it's hard to say whether all the media coverage just about the fact that this was going on was what prompted Apple to really step in, because I think, I mean, and I'm not trying to make Apple sound bad, but some of the developers were starting to ask questions and weren't getting answers at first from Apple. But thankfully, Apple said, "Hey, yeah, we'll look into this," and then, of course, they sent the letter first.
Right, and Lotus has promised $1,000 to any developer to whom they sent a threatening letter if they end up losing this case, which is going to be a little solace to the seven developers who are already in this case, who I'm sure, all of whom I'm sure have already spent more than $1,000 in legal fees just in the past week. On as a side note, this case has made me wonder whether or not it would be worth it for the developers to have some sort of iOS developer trade association that could more easily represent their interests in something like this, where everyone pays in a little bit of money, and Apple and the trade association would jump in and bear the brunt of the legal fees to defend what would essentially be all of the developers should future suits like this crop up.
It's an interesting thought, but it seems, I mean, how many times do you think you'll see something like this? I guess that's the real question.
I guess it depends whether or not Lotus is successful, because if they're not, I don't think you're going to see a lot of them, especially if they're not successful and Apple gets in it. But if they manage to keep Apple out and it's successful, I think we're going to see a lot more of these suits.
Yeah, either that or maybe Apple would then try to license some of the uses of the technology for then the developers, and maybe pay the fees that would be imposed on the developers. You can think of a bunch of different ways they might do that in a way that wouldn't be so bad, helping out sort of the new apps or the new app developers rather than perhaps the companies who are already well suited to paying fees like that, like the Zyngas of the world.
Right, so Apple's solution would be to try to do exactly what they did here, and then that hope that the non-practicing entities do not then turn around and sue the developers anyway.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean the flip side of that is that Apple would probably after this, if they enter into licensing agreements, they're probably going to be a lot more clear that their license also covers anyone who uses their APIs, and that if you try to sue the people who use the APIs for patent infringement, then there's going to be some form of rather severe damages that Apple's going to be seeking.
All right, well, any last thoughts on the story, guys?
I'm all set.
Also,
Moving on to our final story. This week, reports surfaced that Apple is being sued by a company named iCloud Communications for, and you guessed it, using the name iCloud in their new product. Apple announced its new iCloud service just last week at the Worldwide Developers Conference, and it's scheduled to go to market, I think, sometime this fall. According to Apple, the service is going to allow users to store data in a remote cloud-based system and includes music and movies, photos, applications, documents, contacts, and the like. And it will allow users basically to sync the data across multiple devices, for example, across your iPhone, your MacBook, your iPad, any Apple device basically that you have. Apple, in the process of rolling this out, has also acquired the domain name iCloud.com. It's now live, and it's showing Apple's logo that they use for the service. And according to CNET, they spent close to $4.5 million to acquire the domain name and some associated trademark rights from a Swedish company. It sounds like a pretty cool service, but of course this last Thursday, iCloud Communications filed a lawsuit against Apple for unfair business practices under the Lanham Act, and which are basically the portions of the statute that apply common law trademark rights, and trademark infringement under Arizona law in the U.S. District Court for Arizona. A little more background on iCloud Communications. They are a provider of cloud computing products, as they say in their complaint. Computer telephony, hardware and software for the electronic communication of email, text, data, video conferencing, virtual video conferencing, and other content via the internet. And according to the complaint, iCloud Communications spends tens of thousands of dollars annually in regional, national, international, electronic, print, and other advertising to promote its goods and services using its marks. And of course, they also promote their products and services at their website, which you can check out if you want to see what their logos look like at geticloud.com. It's also worth noting, though, that iCloud Communications has apparently not registered its marks with the USPTO, and hence why they are claiming infringement under the common law provisions of the Lanham Act as well as the Arizona laws. So in the complaint, iCloud Communications alleges that Apple's iCloud service is identical or confusingly similar to the iCloud Communications marks. And interestingly, they also say that Apple has a pattern of willful trademark infringement. In this point, they give a couple of examples, that when Apple was sued back in the 1970s by the Beatles label, that's Apple Corporation, and they were again sued by the same company in the 1990s for using iTunes in relation to their marks, which was apparently part of the agreement back in the 1970s that they would not get into the music industry, and that was part of the reason that I think Apple Corp settled the suit. They also point to, of course, other uses, such as using the mark Mighty Mouse for the Apple Mouse product, which was using the same name as the cartoon character, and also selling the iPhone, which was a Cisco mark, for using the mark Macintosh as it applied to their flagship computer line, which was apparently confusingly similar to Management and Consulting Services, also known as Max, which was another company. And there's a bunch of other examples that they point to, saying that Apple has a pattern of willfully infringing other people's marks. And so finally, we'll get down to the meat of this. What they're asking for is preliminary and permanent injunctions against Apple to prevent Apple from using the mark iCloud. They've also requested that Apple destroy all labels, signs, prints, materials, and other things that are associated with the mark. And they're asking for damages, including treble damages under the Arizona Unfair Trade Practices Statute, and invalidation of Apple's registered mark, and oh yes, they also want Apple to transfer that very expensive domain name iCloud.com to them. So that's sort of the gist of the story here. What do you guys think about the lawsuit, and maybe we can talk a bit about what common law trademark rights are?
Well, I think it's pretty ballsy considering they've only got common law trademark rights.
And only common law trademark rights in VoIP services tailored to businesses.
Yeah, and iCloud really isn't VoIP at all.
So I would actually take issue with your assertion that having a common law trademark right is definitely worse than not having the registered rights under the USPTO to use the mark. I mean, one of the big benefits you get from filing with the USPTO is, of course, you sort of have this concept of putting everybody in the nation on notice that you are either going to use a mark or that you are, in fact, using a mark in commerce. After a certain period of time, you can get uncontestability rights with respect to the validity of the mark. After, I think, a five-year period, you file an affidavit. For the, of course, presumption of validity would be a big part of that too, because you're having your mark reviewed by the USPTO. But aside from that, as far as I know, you can still have common law trademark rights, having not registered a mark, and still be considered what we would call the senior user of a mark, so being the one to first use a mark in commerce. And that if it applies enough, given the context, is still enough for you to sue under. Of course, there are the section 1125 in the Lanham Act, that's 15 U.S.C. 1125, is the portions where you can actually sue under for common law trademark rights. It's pretty much the same standard as normal trademark infringement, a likelihood of confusion standard that gets applied. And that's basically what they are suing for here. I think Dominic pinpointed the issue, though, is whether what they are offering is close enough to what Apple is offering. So, Ben, do you think services that Apple's iCloud is going to offer this fall are going to be too different or too distinct from the iCloud communication services?
I mean, there's very little overlap, at least to what I, as far as I can tell, between the two services. But, you know, the question isn't whether or not there's overlap. The question is whether or not somebody looking for, you know, iCloud Corporation's iCloud is going to be confused and think that it's, you know, Apple's iCloud is somehow related to them. And, you know, and the weird thing about this is what we essentially have is a case of reverse trademark infringement, where the senior but less high-profile user is claiming that the junior user is somehow trying to profit off of, you know, the senior user's goodwill, which just isn't the case here. So I guess to back up for a second, one of the things that trademark law tries to prevent is one company benefiting from the goodwill established by another company. And that's not at all what's happening here. Here you've got, the junior user, which is Apple, because they've been using the iCloud trademark for less time, are coming in and basically trying to usurp the rights of the senior user. They're by no means trying to profit off of the goodwill that iCloud Corporation has developed here. iCloud Communications, sorry.
The line that iCloud Communications uses in the complaint, and I'm sort of paraphrasing this a little bit, they sort of reached this conclusion that after the Worldwide Developers Conference, members of the public and the general public basically just associate the mark iCloud now with Apple services rather than iCloud communication services, and that it will be so hard to overcome that their marks are worthless.
Yeah, that's not untrue.
And I think it's factually true that I don't know that necessarily grants them some rights under trademark law, whether it's state trademark laws or the federal trademark laws, in order to get the iCloud domain from Apple. Most likely not. But, it's kind of a crummy thing to have happen. If I was this company, I would start thinking about rebranding and getting new trademarks and also registering new trademarks.
Yeah. I can't imagine that either Apple didn't approach them first and ask them to change their name, or that they didn't try to settle before they filed the suit. But I mean, it was filed so quickly after the iCloud announcement. I get the feeling that Apple must have engaged in some sort of preliminary talks, basically, you know, going up to them and saying, "Hey, we want your trademark." And the only thing I can think of is that they said no or couldn't come to some settlement negotiations and had their lawyers draft this up, you know, between the time that Apple approached them and the time that Apple released announced iCloud.
Right. Maybe the price just wasn't right and they wanted more. So interestingly, one thing about all the history that iCloud Communications points to about all these other companies that have sued Apple or had similar products to Apple products with that lowercase I in front is that most of those other companies, including Cisco with the iPhone, and then I think Fujitsu had at least some rights that might have been associated with the mark iPad, some of those companies did in fact come to licensing agreements or came to other agreements where those companies abandoned the marks that they were using and or assigned them over to Apple for their own use. But they probably got substantial sums of cash in the process.
Apple did that with FaceTime, too. There was some other company that was using the FaceTime mark, and the same day that Apple released FaceTime, which is their video chat software for the iPhone 4, the company that was using FaceTime posted a thing that said, you know, "We are happy to announce that we have licensed the use of FaceTime to someone else and that we are making a new brand and going on with our life."
I'm curious when iCloud Communications was founded, because if it's like in the last 2 or 3 years. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's it's plausible. The iPod existed, the iMac existed. It was kind of
like, well, here, this is interesting too. They call themselves a cloud computing company, but you know, after having been to their website, and I haven't really been through it very carefully, it looks like most of their products are just VoIP products, which I wouldn't really classify those as being cloud computing products or services.
And I feel like the term the cloud wasn't really a thing in 2005. I mean, that was 6 years ago. I don't remember anyone talking about the cloud in 2005.
That's a good question.
The iCloud Wikipedia page actually talks about Apple's thing. There apparently wasn't one for the company beforehand. Looking at cloud itself, the references in Wikipedia are all in the last 2 or 3 years, which is, cloud sort of started becoming really popular in 2009, I'd say. I mean, the earliest references I see in here is like 2008. So, yeah. Kind of weird.
Yeah, it sounds like they saw that Apple was announcing this and tried to position themselves in a way to try to extract the most money out of Apple. Because one of the things that they ask for is for Apple to destroy all of the promotional materials that, of the promotional materials and actual use in commerce of iCloud, which at this point is not feasible for Apple to do, except at great cost.
Yeah, thinking back to use of the cloud, I don't know why I'm so stuck on that, because it's not terribly relevant, but Google Docs was announced, I think, in 2006. So that was some time ago. I do feel like people were sort of talking about the cloud. I just don't think it was a popularized term around then. So in any event, there's one other thing that iCloud Communications points to in the complaint, and that's they look at the application that Apple has filed with the USPTO for intent to use the mark, and they list among the services that the iCloud mark will apply to telecommunications access services, communications by computer, communications between computers, yada, yada, yada. There's a whole bunch of sort of related terms that are mostly about computer communications or even video content streaming. And I could see how that might bear some connection then to VoIP-related services. If you take the most obvious example, Skype, you're talking about voice over IP. So you have two computers that are being connected sometimes with a couple of servers in between, and you're exchanging content back and forth, and sometimes that includes a live video stream and a chat stream as in addition to the voice stream. It just doesn't sound at this point from the description that Apple has given us from WWDC that what they are going to be offering in the fall really is all that close to what iCloud Communications is going to be offering.
Yeah, Apple doesn't do any VoIP apart from FaceTime, I guess. That's more video than VoIP. Although there is voice, so. It's not called Mime Time or anything. Bada boom.
Yep, you are going to be syncing, though, it sounds like a broad range of stuff in Apple's iCloud, and that might include some of the things that are sort of incidental to the iCloud communication services. So what this is all signaling to me is that there are some factual issues here that underlie this, whether there's actually a likelihood of confusion between these two marks or whether there would be to the average consumer. I don't know. It looks close to me in some parts of this as I read through the complaint and think about it. And then part of me is like, well, you know what? I don't really know what Apple's service is actually going to look like in the fall. Maybe a lot will change. Maybe what they've put out in terms of marketing materials and what's on that iCloud.com website is, you know, different from what it will actually look like in the fall. So do either of you guys want to hedge an opinion or speculate as to who will be the victor in this case?
Apple wins.
I think it's going to settle at some point, probably after the preliminary injunction is denied and after some less than favorable rulings from the judge on the part of iCloud with regards to their likelihood of winning most of the things that they want.
I'm not too sure how I feel about the section that claims Apple has this pattern of willful trademark infringement. They point to all these historical examples. Well, it's kind of fun to read through that to see all of Apple's, you know, all the times that they've come into trademark issues with other companies and products they're coming out. I feel like it's not very relevant at all, and it probably wouldn't be admissible within a court of law to say that, yeah, this establishes the fact that they're doing this willfully to us. Probably what would have been more relevant is if they said, hey, Apple approached us back in, you know, X number of months ago about using this mark and asking us to stop using the mark, and, you know, this is how the exchange went. We refused. We were looking for licensing fees. They refused to pay the license fees. Then they did it anyway. You know, that's something that is a bit more willful to me than saying, oh, if you look back to the 70s at the beginning of Apple, they had all these problems with the Beatles record label, and then since then they've had a number of you know, problems with other companies as they release these new products with a lowercase I slash product name. So, final thoughts from the panel?
I'm all set.
All set here.
All right, well, on that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's show. As always, you can find our blog and podcast on the web at technicallylegal.org, on Twitter as @techlegal, and feel free to send comments and story suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
We'll see you next week. Take care.